History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories around you that really should not go untold. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Fresno, California with 101-year-old Jack Wolf. He has quite a story. He has quite a legacy. Just sitting in his office, I see the pictures of all 24 of his grandkids who never would have been born if he didn't survive World War II, let alone his impact on the agricultural industry in California and in the world. But let's go way back, Jack. You grew up in Arizona. You had a twin brother. Eventually, you'd have a couple other siblings. Tell me what those earliest memories of being a kid in Arizona were like for you.
Well, we grew up on a farm, and the Great Depression, of course, came along, and my father decided that he needed a monthly check, so he went the dairy route, and he started out with about 10 cows, and we grew to have a herd of about 50 cows that we milked every day. That meant morning and evening. And I had a twin brother, and so between the three, my father and my brother and myself, we milked those cows every morning and every evening. That I remember vividly. My father always told us that the mechanical milker wasn't good for the cows. But when my brother and I left to go to business school in Los Angeles, he got a mechanical milker. No, times were difficult, as we call them. But everyone else was in the same position. So we weren't selected or by ourselves. Wages of that day is hard for folks today to think. You recall that my father would hire a man to work on the farm, and he paid $1 a day, and that was a 12-hour day, which meant he was getting just a little over 8 cents an hour.
Well, and I've got to ask you, you made that comment about your father and the mechanical milker. Are you saying that now you think that was just his excuse, that he had to tell you it was bad for the cows so you and your brother would keep milking them?
Probably. That was probably it.
And I know that you can't have the kind of career you've had without hard work, without discipline. But have you ever worked harder than on that dairy, milking those cows morning and evening and probably going to school in between?
Well, I wouldn't say that. It was different type of work. After college and World War II, I ended up and went to work for Mr. Russell Giffen. Over the time, I became a business manager and spent a lot of hours.
I know this is a long time ago. If you're 101 years old and I say, tell me about when you're 8 or 9 or 10, but do you remember as a boy having some ideas? Hey, when I grow up, here's the kind of life I'm going to have, or here's the kind of job I'm going to have. Did you have those dreams or ambitions?
Not when I was 8 or 9 that I can recall. As a teenager, I thought that if I could have a chance, I would chase it pretty hard.
And you mentioned going to business school, and you and your twin brother went together. Were you two pretty close? Did you have that twin connection people talk about?
Yes, we were close. As we got to be young men, we began to poke one another in the eye in a way. I recall one time having lunch with him in Phoenix, and a banker came along that we both knew, and he told the banker that I was okay, but I was slow pay. So anyway, we had that sort of a relationship. We visited about once every 10 days the rest of our lives.
So you go to business school together, and then you get done with that, and you go to work, and the war still hasn't come yet. In those late 30s, was there any hint because of what was going on in other parts of the world that you had any concern you might end up in the service?
Yes, we left together with three other guys about our age. So there were five of us in one place. We were conversation about what might be happening.
And then you heard about this peacetime draft?
Yes, we definitely. Well, we had to go down and register. That put the emphasis that you knew you were going to go in for 1 year.
1 year. Yeah, that's not exactly what happened, I know. But how did you feel about that at the time? Because I'm sure you're trying to progress in your job and you have these ideas and, you know, here's this life in front of you and Uncle Sam says, hey, we need you in uniform.
Well, that was just part of the time. Then we accepted that we had to do that. I don't recall of dwelling on it particularly. I thought at that time that we'd go in and have 1 year because even the government was saying that we would not be getting involved in the European thing. But then Pearl Harbor came along and we all knew that we were going to be stuck in there for a while.
Well, and I want to ask you about that day because everyone seems to remember something about December 7th. But with regard to your brother, was he drafted as well?
He got drafted about 30 days after I got caught. We were living in Los Angeles, so we were inducted at San Pedro. And when you were in San Pedro, they asked you which service that you thought you'd like to train on. And he said infantry, and I said Coast Artillery. I thought Coast Artillery sounded a little safer.
Well, we'll hear about that a little later. And the only reason I ask is I've talked to a lot of veterans who had siblings or best buddies that they went in together with, and they thought, hey, we'll be able to stay together throughout the service. It sounds like you and your brother never even thought of that.
No, we did not think about joining together.
And what kind of outfit did he end up with?
He ended up in the 79th Regiment Infantry. He went overseas about 6 months after D-Day.
And you were a little closer to D-Day than that, but let's talk about December 7th, 1941. Where were you and how'd you find out what had happened out at Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was at Camp Callan near La Jolla, near San Diego. There was a handful of three or four of us had gone to Tijuana to do what you do in Tijuana. We had a radio on, and we heard about Pearl Harbor and the instructions to get back to your base.
How did things change after that? Did you notice a difference in your Army experience after Pearl Harbor?
Well, yes. In my case, before Pearl Harbor, an acquaintance of mine came by to visit, and she had her current gentleman friend was a retired Navy officer. He told me that I should sign up for officer school, and I thought, he doesn't know that I'm getting out in just a few months, and I didn't do anything about it. Wherever they had gone, they came back, and they stopped again after 2 or 3 weeks, and that time he made a push again that I consider officer school, and he made the point that in his judgment there would be a war. And he presented the premise that I had about 4 months left, and if I got accepted soon, in 90 days I'd be an officer. And so it overlapped. I really wasn't going to get caught. If there was a war, I would be in better shape. If there wasn't, it wasn't bad to have. So anyway, that's what happened.
Have you ever wondered how your war experience would have been different had you not taken his advice?
Well, I don't think I ever dwelled on that. I did think that it was a plus, personally, to be an officer.
Well, and back in those days, what was officer candidate school like? How did they treat you? What did they make you do?
The first step, you had to take an exam to show how much smarts, I guess. Anyway, I aced that dude. I wasn't all that bright, but whatever number they asked me, it just so happened I did quite well. And so I was told that I had been accepted and I would be notified of where the school would be. I didn't know that they were just setting it up, and they set it up at Wilmington, North Carolina. And I didn't hear anything. I kept going by about once a week to a headquarters at Camp Cowan to inquire, do they have any word? And one day Pearl Harbor happens, and within the week I had a notice to move in 2 weeks.
So I guess I should put this in context, too. Over the years that followed, as you become an officer, and then you're called to lead all these other young men, you were probably one of the old men, weren't you, even though you're only 24, 25 years old?
I don't know that I ever thought of it that way, but anyway, there were some quite a few younger ones than myself.
You had requested Coast Artillery, and they end up putting you in charge of a gun battery, Battery A of the 204th AAA Anti-Aircraft Artillery. Can you explain what that meant, what your duties consisted of, how much you were responsible for?
Well, let me digress just a moment. I was assigned to a battalion, and they were heading for Panama for jungle training, and they gave us a yellow fever shot, and about half of the folks, including myself, had an adverse effect. We all came down with jaundice. I went to the dispensary, and they said, here's another one. And so I was laid up for about 30 days to get rid of that jaundice. Meanwhile, my unit went to Panama, and they ended up in the South Pacific. So I had missed them. And I spent about the next 4 months as part of a train crew. We would pick up folks from Kilmer and take them all the way on a troop train all the way to the West Coast, San Francisco. And I made 3 or 4 cross trips. And when I learned that there was a new gun and aircraft, I signed up for that. After about 60 days training on that, I was sent to Camp Edwards on Cape Cod.
Well, I guess maybe I should ask, too, because time is passing, and you just mentioned, you know, you would have been heading to the South Pacific. Who knows how different your life would have been in that case, if you even made it back from the war. But you're going cross-country on these trains, and it just hits me, how different was the atmosphere of America back then? Can you describe for us the sentiment or the feeling or the unity that existed in the country then?
Well, if you needed a ride and you were in uniform, all you had to do was get out on the curb and put your thumb up, and there'd be about 3 cars stopped to pick you up. There was no question that the feeling was very strong by everyone.
So Cape Cod, more training, and are you itching to get overseas? Do you want a piece of this fight, or are you content to be exactly where you are?
No, I don't recall having any thoughts that I wanted to get there. I just knew that we would probably end up and be there. You accepted that was happening. But from Cape Cod, we had training on Long Island, maneuvers they called them, and then maneuvers on that going out toward Provincetown on Cape Cod. And we traipsed around that part of the country, and we ended up at Fort Devens near Boston, and that's where we were outfitted to go overseas, and we left in early January of 1944.
And how much were you responsible for at that point? Who were you in charge of, or what were the duties that you had to maintain and keep an eye on?
I don't know whether it's boring to you. When we had the first 40-millimeter gun, they had a manual telling you how to get it in place of firing, and the commanding colonel, chicken colonel, full colonel, told us that we were never to deviate. And I raised my hand and told him that I thought we had found a way to do it better. We had a demonstration of what we were doing, and he said, write that up for and send it to my headquarters. And shortly, the Campbell Amendment came down the pike. From that, our battalion commander tagged me to be S3, in charge of operations and so forth for the battalion. I did that at Cape Cod, and it was about when we were at Long Island that they decreed that the S3 should be a major. But we had 2 or 3 guys that had been in the National Guard and had something like 20 years experience. And they, of course, seniority-wise, preceded me. They told me that I should cease being S3 and I would change places with Bob Denig, who had charge of Battery A. And so I switched and became battery commander of Battery A. I came to enjoy that a lot.
Well, and I don't want to gloss over what you just said either. So it sounds like you're saying that you came up with an innovation for how those anti-aircraft units were going to do their job. What was the idea you figured out, and ultimately, what was the implication of that?
Well, if one was to simplify the thing, the manual had said you dig a hole in the ground and put the gun, and you had three places that you had to lower it, but we found that you could do it all at one time rather than this leg and then this leg and this leg, and that's what the manual said. And we did it all at one time and just dropped them. From that point on, Colonel Campbell had a little, I thought, an interest in what I was doing, because he would come by periodically. And he was about 60 years old, had been at West Point. Anyway, it was the start of a relationship. And after we were overseas, we were notified that we would come under a different group of anti-aircraft people, and the head was Colonel Campbell.
Well, and I don't want to oversimplify or get it wrong, but it sounds like you're saying just by seeing a better way to do something, you probably save these gun crews time. And in war, I mean, in business they say time is money, but in war, time could be life or death, right?
Well, that's one way to word it. It's just simplified in the time we could get in position to fire. But, you know, the guns of that day is so different than what they have today. They didn't have any of the computerized thing, and so it was kind of get it into shape and make sure it's level, because what controls and guidance we had premised on being absolutely flat.
Well, and not to fast forward too far, but it just makes me wonder in my mind, because I know about some of the things you've done in farming, and, you know, the sustained success you've had in passing it on to your kids and grandkids now. Is that something, that idea of, hey, there might be a better way to do this, is that a pattern that's followed you through the rest of these 101 years?
Well, I guess I'd have to say I'm kind of bent that way. I've never dwelled on that aspect of it, but certainly in the military, we tried to do that.
Time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 101-year-old Jack Wolf of Fresno, California. As a farmer, a businessman, and philanthropist, he's built quite a legacy. His family stewards thousands and thousands of acres today, but before he owned even a small parcel of land, he had to make it through an infamously dangerous stretch of sand called Omaha Beach in June 1944. We'll hear about that when we come back. And if you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of the orders he received before the Normandy invasion. He still has them nearly 75 years later. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.